This is VOA's Plugged In Podcast.
On this episode of Plugged In, a tale of two African countries. Mozambique struggles to recover from the worst cyclone in the nation's recent history. What are international aid groups doing to get the country back on its feet? Then, Rwanda remembers 100 days of terror that led to the deaths of nearly a million people. We look back with an eye to the future on the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. Could it happen again?
Hello and welcome to Plugged In. I'm Jim Malone, filling in for Greta Van Susteren. We begin with the aftermath to one of the worst tropical cyclones to strike the Southeast African country of Mozambique. Cyclone Idai left a trail of devastation in its wake, more than 600 people killed, and more than 100,000 lost their homes. VOA reporter Brian Padden accompanied one relief agency to survey some of the hardest hit areas and filed this report from the port city of Beira.
An empty field in the center of the town of Buzi has become a helicopter landing pad and a major supply site after Cyclone Idai destroyed the connecting road to the port city of Beira. The World Food Program is providing free flights to relief agencies to bring in cargo and evacuate those badly injured from the storm that blew off corrugated metal roofs from homes, knocked down power lines, and caused severe flooding in many areas.
The water level inside the house was so high, we could not even walk to seek help.
Much of the local hospital was severely damaged in the flood. International assistance organizations are working to coordinate relief efforts. The American-based Samaritan's Purse has set up a mobile clinic where hundreds of patients line up daily.
So far, we're still seeing lots of wounds from the floods. People have cut their feet on iron sheets and falling bits of trees and houses and things. There's a few patients with diarrhea inside, but no cholera that we can see so far.
Many of the patients had been sick before the storm, but were unable to seek medical attention after the hospital was severely damaged.
I'm just very happy because I received treatment. We suffered so much during the cyclone.
The relief organization is building and bringing in medical supplies for an expanded treatment facility to be used until the hospital is rebuilt.
So it'll be a support system until they're ready to take back over, and we'll leave the stuff behind so they have added supplies and added structures.
The International Red Cross is also sending in clean water, tents, and other supplies, enough for about 20,000 people. The United Nations is appealing for $282 million to provide disaster aid in Mozambique for the next 3 months.
VOA's Brian Padden is back from Beira in central Mozambique and joins us now here on the set. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you.
A lot's been going on there. You were there recently. Any new developments since you left? I mean, how's the overall aid going there?
Well, the search and recovery efforts now has shifted mostly to recovery. The waters have, for the most part, receded. International aid organizations are focusing on making sure there's no secondary humanitarian crisis, making sure people have food, making sure there's reestablishing a supply of clean water, and trying to prevent spread of diseases like cholera.
So it's always the initial aftermath of devastation and then trying to deal with these longer, more chronic, longer-term issues that crop up. I just wonder, give us a sense of the scope of what you saw. I mean, this was really a devastating storm.
Well, I think one thing that particularly struck me was the endemic poverty that existed in most of this region before the storm. So a storm like this, the people there, the population is already on a razor's edge of poverty. So with a storm that kind of wipes out crops, that destroys roads and bridges, access to things like water, things and the food that they depended on, that is gone immediately, and there's no one there except for international relief agencies to kind of provide that initial help.
Right. You went in with a private aid group. Tell us briefly about that and what they were focused on doing.
Right. So I went in with a group called Samaritan's Purse. I was part of a small VOA team who went in. We traveled on their cargo plane into the country. We arrived at the Beira Airport at night. It was, I guess, an odd time we were landing, or it was a very busy time for the airport. It seemed like electricity was out when we arrived. We had to wait for over an hour to get off the plane. We had to get off the plane on using a ladder because they didn't have any of these little steps, mobile steps, that would come in. And from there we embedded with this group and we went out on the road. I went with them for about 3 or 4 days to kind of document the different activities that they were involved in.
About 30 seconds left, but this is going to be a long-term process of recovery, is it not?
Well, these aid organizations are looking at a 1 to 3 month surge of assistance and to try to kind of reestablish the infrastructure that was there in the past.
Right. Well, Brian, thanks very much for your reporting, and as always, great job out there. Appreciate it. Among the biggest dangers facing the people of Mozambique in the aftermath of that storm is the threat of a cholera epidemic. Here's Brian Padden again on international efforts to keep the deadly virus in check.
The floodwaters from Cyclone Idai have mostly receded in the Mozambican city of Beira. It was hardest hit by the storm, but has left behind hundreds of contaminated wells in the neighborhood of Manyaba. The American relief organization Samaritan's Purse has recently begun sanitizing these wells that are a likely source of the recent cholera outbreak here.
There's endemic cholera in this area, and there's been a few positive cases here at the Manyaba Hospital, just a block over that way.
Cholera is a stomach virus spread often by contaminated water sources and can be deadly if not treated in its early stages. Humanitarian organizations, including Doctors Without Borders and the International Red Cross, have set up health clinics to treat the rising number of cholera cases. The World Health Organization has shipped more than 900,000 doses of cholera vaccines, and the U.S. Agency for International Development is also financially supporting the vaccination campaign as part of its $7 million contribution to disaster assistance.
The Ministry of Health is leading the efforts in ensuring that the communities where there's a possible risk of this particular diarrheal illness coming to affect the community, that there's an opportunity for people to receive the vaccine ahead of being exposed.
Sanitizing one contaminated well can reduce the risk of infection for an entire neighborhood.
We have more than 200 people who use this well from all over this area.
But it is a labor-intensive process where workers first pump out contaminated water, then treat the well with a powerful chlorine agent to kill harmful bacteria. The next day, the well is again pumped to dilute the chlorine.
We are not going to clean all the wells, but those that are most used by population, those that have provided good water in the past.
Despite the surge of international assistance, the cholera situation remains difficult to contain in a country with already widespread poverty and still facing a long recovery from the extensive cyclone damage.
Thanks again to VOA's Brian Padden for that report. It will be a long and difficult recovery for a country already reeling from poverty, even before the storm hit. It's a burden that this country of more than 29 million people, will have to bear for years to come. Joining us now to discuss the human element of this natural tragedy and what's next for the people of Mozambique is VOA Portuguese to Africa Service reporter Amancio Miguel, who spoke to survivors of Cyclone Idai. Well, sir, welcome to Plugged In. Thanks for joining us.
Give us a sense,
you're originally from Mozambique, how people are coping with the scope of this disaster.
Thank you, Jim. There are various scenarios. One of the scenarios that I would like to highlight is that those who were already unemployed, for example, are suffering the most due to this cyclone. Those with jobs are trying to recover.
Right.
And among these groups, I would like also to single out women and children. Women face the most of the impact of the cyclone. 2 weeks after the cyclone, we see people going back to their work, people trying to reestablish their small business. But those who are already unemployed, like Brian said, they face most difficult. They cannot. They don't know really how to how to go on about this.
Tell me about the resiliency of local people there, and how have people decided to help themselves instead of waiting for the government, which is already strapped in terms of trying to help them.
These are people used to suffer. Mozambique had like 16 years of civil war, long years of famine, and long years of poverty. So there was actually a movement that started in Maputo, which is the capital. People from the south went on to collect like goods to help the people in Beira.
Right.
They managed to get like 76 containers that went in a ship to the port city of Beira. So there was this kind of support. But this support is just for food and clothes. But the main issue that faced the poorest of the population of Beira, especially in neighborhoods like Munyava, is after the accommodation camps, where are they going to? Because there's no any signal for, any sign from the government as to whether the government is going to help them to rebuild their house. So there's this like this question: where are we going from here? So
this is going to be a long-term challenge, isn't it, to get the country back up to even where it was before? I mean, are we going to see more international aid efforts to help the government here?
It's going to be a long term, but also one thing that is to be highlighted, that the city of Beira before the cyclone was not in a good, was facing a lot of problems. The city itself had like many buildings like they were affected, but the shanty towns, the slum areas where the poorest live, they were totally devastated. So they are really, really down. It's going to take a long time. But it's not clear for the people what's going to happen to their lives. We have news coming from Beira at this time saying that some people are leaving accommodation camps, but these are the people that can afford going to do their small business, petty jobs. They can rebuild their house. But those who cannot, they will remain in camps for long times and with no clear solution for their lives.
Well, Amancio, thank you for that, and we'll rely on you to keep us keep tabs on what's going on in Mozambique. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, you. Thank you very much.
Some 2,000 kilometers north of Mozambique, the Central African country of Rwanda is remembering a different kind of nightmare to honor the victims of the Rwandan genocide 25 years ago. More on that somber anniversary now from Plugged In's Steve Reddish.
President Kagame lit a remembrance torch and laid a wreath at the genocide memorial site where over a quarter million victims of the 1994 massacre are buried.
25 years later, here we are, all of us. Wounded and heartbroken, yes, but unvanquished.
Rwanda will mourn for 100 days, the time it took to kill hundreds of thousands of people, mostly ethnic Tutsis and some moderate Hutus. The slaughter began on the night of April 6, 1994, after a plane carrying the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi was shot down near the Kigali airport. Extremist Hutu-led forces killed about 10,000 people a day. About 2 million people fled the country.
I give my heart 1,000 times over to the survivors and their children, those who have had to move forward and rebuild their lives through such pain and ever with the images seared into their memories.
Commemorations were also held in France, which is home to many survivors.
I often say that we, the people who survived that attack, the luck we had is that April 8th was at the very beginning of the genocide, and therefore the Red Cross could still operate, and there were still good souls who could oppose that horror, but also help the Tutsis.
Before the genocide, France had supported the Hutu-led government against the Tutsi-dominated opposition. The victorious opposition had accused the French of enabling Hutu killers, which Paris had long denied. French President Emmanuel Macron appointed a group of experts to investigate French actions during the massacres in an effort to end 25 years of tensions with Rwanda.
Nous nous souvenons.
We remember, we commemorate, we have made April 7th an official day, and above all, now we'll work with this independent commission of historians who have to shed light on what happened in Rwanda 25 years ago.
The genocide ended in July 1994, after the forces of the rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front, led by Kagame, entered the country from Uganda and defeated Rwanda's military Hutu leaders.
In 2004, the horrors of the Rwandan genocide were brought to the mainstream by way of the critically acclaimed film Hotel Rwanda.
I have no means to protect these people.
The film stars Academy Award-nominated actor Don Cheadle as Paul Rusesabagina, Hutu hotel manager who risks his life to save the lives of hundreds of Tutsi refugees who have taken refuge in his hotel.
And the world turned its back.
How can they not intervene? Hundreds of thousands are dying. We have been abandoned.
That 2004 movie played an important part in shining a light on the atrocities that took place in Rwanda 25 years ago. VOA's Africa Service traveled to Rwanda to hear some of those haunting stories firsthand. Here's a look at that dark period in Rwanda's history through the eyes of the people who lived through it.
The night of April 6th to 7th, when Habyarimana's plane crashed, in the morning, local leaders gave orders that no one should go out. They ordered us all to stay at home. Massacres here at Nyamirabu started on the 7th. In Hirahamwe, militia launched their attacks with guns and grenades. We then decided that whoever could had to run into Gishwari Forest. Some of us managed to run away and escaped, but others were killed on the spot.
I lost my brother together with his wife and four children. The entire family was wiped out, and it's not only his family. In our village, there are families that have been wiped out. Unfortunately, we do not even have any of their photos.
What remains in my mind that I will never forget is the death of my wife and children. That still haunts me every time. I was hiding with them in the house. But I left first as I did not want to see them being killed. However, when I approached the door to go out, the invader struck me with a machete on the neck and I fell over. So I could listen whatever happened inside the house, even their screams.
I was 12 years when genocide ended, and I had nobody to rely on. I had no one to take care of me. First of all, forgiveness relieves the one who forgives than it does to the one forgiven. I accepted what happened to us, that our loved ones were killed by other people we didn't know all the people we knew. Our hearts are clean. We forgive them, even though some of them didn't ask for forgiveness.
Long ago, when someone lost a husband, her family or other people would help her. But for us, it was different. You would think you're the only one in that situation, but later you realize that there are others like you. I think reconciliation is necessary because a country without reconciliation is a divided country. We would be heading nowhere. I think even those who have not yet forgiven should go ahead and forgive to enable reconciliation to take place, because if you have a grudge at heart, you can never live well with your neighbors.
So 25 years after the horrendous genocide in Rwanda, how is the country faring today? And what progress is there to report on national reconciliation? Here to discuss the current state of affairs in Rwanda is Etienne Karakazi, managing editor for VOA's Central Africa Service. Welcome, sir. This has got to be a difficult anniversary for the people of Rwanda. Tell us this: what the country is feeling at the moment as they look back and at the same time they try to look ahead to the future.
Thank you, Jim. As you said, as you saw these different survivors of genocide, of course, the victims, what you can feel in the eyes, it's this trauma, but also the sense of hope and reconciliation 25 years after, because these are victims of genocide, this tragedy that fell on Rwanda 25 years ago. But again, if you look at the steps taken by the government, especially in terms of reconciliation, especially in terms of what the government calls it's a policy, actually, never again a concept which says never again to genocide. I believe people are feeling some kind of hope and peace coming soon.
I've seen stories where there's these sort of experimental communities where people, antagonists, are kind of living together, trying to bring together reconciliation. I mean, are there tensions below the surface, though, between the ethnic groups in Rwanda, or has the focus somewhat succeeded in trying to emphasize reconciliation and forgiveness?
What the government has done so far, at least we can really commend it, is this concept of transactional reconciliation, especially through the traditional Gacaca courts, where people would come together and try to discuss what happened exactly in order to move forward. Of course, this can imply some kind of immediate harmony between the people who are usually live together in communities. But I believe that deeper than that, people on individual level, community level, then national level, they can establish kind of sincere dialogue to discuss exactly what happened and how people can move forward.
Tell me now, it's been 25 years. You have a new generation of people coming into Rwanda, young people. How is this being framed for them? Is there a hope there that they can move beyond the scars of 25 years ago and sort of lead the country into a more sort of reconciled direction?
The government and different groups are trying to educate the young people to look beyond what can divide them, especially in terms of ethnicity, the Hutu and the Tutsi especially, but look at how they can live together as Rwandans. Again, to stress what's important for Rwanda again here is that Rwandans can't be viewed between the Hutu and Tutsi dichotomy because they have a lot of intermarriages between Hutu and Tutsi. You can have a nephew, a half-brother or a brother who can be from the other ethnic group, which means this tragedy basically touched almost every Rwandan family. It would be hard to imagine any Rwandan family which are not really affected by the genocide, which brings me to think that to some extent, people should feel that every victim should feel vindicated to some extent. Just have to be fair, just have to be timely, and it just has to be equal for everybody.
I wonder, too, as Rwandans mark this anniversary, is there any concern that some of the ill feelings or some of the bad memories could resurface in terms of additional tensions, or what are you observing right now in terms of inside the country?
Yeah, my observation is that I believe most people understand that the genocide that took place 25 years ago was a huge tragedy for Rwanda, and the people should do everything possible to avoid it. Let's move forward, especially for the young generation. And my feeling is that the government has done, or at least is doing, taking every steps possible to avoid going back into what happened 25 years ago. And I believe with some kind of national stability, and especially the openness of political space and respect of human rights at every level, this can help people move forward, especially by avoiding what happened 25 years ago. But I believe one of the conditions, of course, is to leave the free space for everybody, allow people to speak freely, and then allow those who still feel that they are victims of any kind of atrocity express their feelings or express how they feel reconciliation can be achieved.
No, the President, Paul Kagame, is a key figure in all this. He's been in charge there since the aftermath of these horrible genocide. Is he going to be remaining in office for the foreseeable future? Is he still going to be leading the country? What's the political outlook there?
The political outlook in Rwanda is that with the recent reform of the constitution, President Kagame can again run for another term, actually 5-year term instead of 7, which was previously the case for the constitution. So he may run, he may not run, we don't know it so far, but at least we have no indication that he'll be stepping aside to let somebody move forward. And I hope within the ruling party, the Rwandese Patriotic Front, hopefully somebody else can be able to take over, at least Kagame allowing that. But I believe it's an open door. Kagame can say, I'm stepping aside. Somebody can move in, or at least, or maybe the opposition can be given an opportunity, because it's a question of opportunity, to let other people just move the country forward.
Well, Etienne, thanks so much for sharing this. It's got to be a difficult time for all of Rwanda's people to mark this occasion. But thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today on Plugged In.
Thank you for the opportunity, Jim.
Before we go, some closing thoughts on the deteriorating state of press freedom around the world. As part of an ongoing media crackdown, the government of Burundi has banned both Voice of America and the BBC from broadcasting in its country. Burundi's media regulator, the National Communication Council, recently announced that it had pulled the operating license for the BBC and renewed the suspension of VOA. Both outlets were originally suspended in May of 2018. Journalists in Burundi are prohibited from speaking with or providing information to Voice of America, and VOA and BBC journalists have been expelled from the country. Now, in response, the agency's indefinite ban, Voice of America Director Amanda Bennett stated the following: "We are alarmed that reporters in Burundi are now forbidden to communicate with VOA and believe these continuing threats to our journalists undermine press freedom in the country. We stand with the people of Burundi against those who are restricting their access to accurate and reliable news and information." Burundian government officials have repeatedly claimed that both the VOA and BBC broadcast, quote, what they call fake news. We'll keep you posted on developments in this story. That's all the time we have for today. Stay plugged in by liking us on Facebook at Voice of America. You can also like Greta's Facebook page at facebook.com/Greta. Follow Greta on Twitter at Greta. Thanks, as always, for being plugged in.
Thanks for listening to VOA's Plugged In.